I'm going to be talking from a monograph that we published back in July, and I passed around flyers. There's some more in the chair right there that I was sitting on, so please take one. You can check this out online. And I have no relationships to disclose. So what I want to do today is briefly talk about what we see as the great potential of pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention, and talk about some specific potential barriers to use and to getting this out into the community. So based on this monograph, pre-exposure prophylaxis basically involves taking a medication to prevent infection. So people with HIV take antiretrovirals for treatment purposes, and pre-exposure prophylaxis involves taking antiretroviral medications that are designed for treatment, but a negative person taking them and using them to make themselves less susceptible to HIV infection. We do this with malaria. People who don't have malaria but are going to a country like in sub-Saharan Africa where malaria is quite prevalent will take malarial medications as pre-exposure prophylaxis. And what this monograph does is it summarizes the research on PrEP as well as on microbicides, which is a related biomedical prevention intervention that's pretty much experimental at this point. It looks at not only efficacy and safety research, but also implementation and cost-effectiveness research. And it looks at a bunch of other things that I'm going to skip over in the interest of time. But I want to make clear that we're very optimistic about the potential for PrEP to really transform the epidemic. I feel like it's kind of like 1996 with the advent of antiretroviral therapy for the first time, when we could really start to, you know, keep people alive and improve the quality of life of people who were infected with HIV. I feel like we're at that kind of transition point in the epidemic. And this is really the consensus of most AIDS activists, AIDS care providers, and preventionists. This is a slide that shows some of the different biomedical interventions that have shown efficacy. So the Michael Shankel mentioned treatment as prevention, which is the first one listed here, a study that was released in July 2011 at the AIDS conference in Rome. And this was a study with serodiscordant couples, in other words, one's positive, one's negative, heterosexual couples, and it showed that there was a 96% lower rate of infection among those couples in which the negative partner was taking, in which the positive partner was fully adherent to antiretroviral treatment. Then the second and third studies are a couple of PrEP studies with heterosexuals, mostly one with serodiscordant couples in Kenya and Tanzania, and the other one in Botswana with an overwhelmingly heterosexual sample, showed that the overall sample had a rate of between 63 and 73% lower HIV infection. And then the fifth study there is the IPREC study. It's a study that we were involved with at Fenway, and it was really an international study. And it showed 44% lower rates of HIV infection for MSM involved in the study. But for those who were treatment adherent, the rate was actually 92% lower rate of HIV infection. So a very promising study. Modeling has shown that PrEP combined with treatment as prevention could dramatically reduce new HIV infection. I list several studies that we go into detail in the monograph if you're interested in learning more about them. But in a country like Botswana, which has a relatively small population, you know, the widespread dissemination of PrEP and treatment as prevention for those who are positive could really reduce infection rates dramatically. So Abdul Karim, our husband and wife research team, who have argued for putting out PrEP with treatment as prevention synergistically. And if this is done, it's really critical that that this sort of dichotomy between prevention and treatment be broken down. We're starting to do it. I'm glad that I'm on a treatment panel talking about a biomedical prevention intervention. That's great. But what that means in the U.S. is that HRSA and CDC have to work really closely together and coordinate this, and similarly at the global level, the prevention and treatment folks have to work more closely than they have in the past. Studies have shown that if PrEP is targeted to the most vulnerable populations, in other words, you know, high-risk MSM, sex workers, serodiscordant heterosexual couples, and if adherence is high, that it can be cost-effective. So here's a number of studies which, again, we review in the monograph. It can be cost-effective in the U.S. if there's 90% efficacy. In other words, lower rates of infection up to 90%, which we saw in IPREX with the adherent men who have sex with men in that study. Some of the concerns raised about PrEP, there's really three key concerns. One, that there'll be side effects, some related to kidney function, for example. Another is that there'll be risk compensation, that people will say, oh, if I take PrEP, then I don't have to use condoms. And that's a really important message that we're trying to get out there, that the FDA got out there when it approved the use of tenofovir, emtricitabine, for pre-exposure prophylaxis of HIV. They said this is not a substitute for a condom. You have to continue to use condoms to really be certain that you're not going to get infected. And then drug resistance is another concern. But a review of five major clinical trials involving about 6,000 participants by the Forum for Collaborative HIV Research shows no greater risk of any of these concerns, side effects, risk compensation, or drug resistance in participants. So these are things that we have to certainly monitor very closely, but they're not a reason not to make PrEP available to people who can benefit from it. PrEP should be accompanied by sustained care to monitor, for example, side effects, as well as behavioral interventions to push up adherence to as high as we can possibly get and to minimize risk compensation. I talked about combining PrEP with treatment as prevention. It's also essential that that behavioral and structural interventions be combined with this biomedical technology. Because those who are most at risk of HIV and who could benefit the most from PrEP often are not in regular care, that it's important to have alternative implementation arrangements. This could include making PrEP available at a STD clinic, making it available at a drug treatment facility. And national monitoring is critical to keep an eye on the drug resistance concern. Another barrier is just lack of knowledge in the communities that could benefit from PrEP as well as among providers. So a lot of men who have sex with men who are, you know, really disproportionately impacted by HIV in this country and around the world, there's limited knowledge about PrEP, but when people are told what it is and what it could potentially offer them, they tend to be pretty open to using it. Many providers are unfamiliar with both pre-exposure prophylaxis as well as post-exposure prophylaxis. This is when you think you've been exposed to HIV and you take, within 72 hours, you go to a doctor and you start taking a 28-day course of antiretrovirals to minimize your chance of getting infected. That's PEP. And a lot of people, they're not sure which is PEP, what's the difference between PEP and PrEP. A lot of providers are not really familiar with this. I was speaking at NYU last year at a law school class, and a guy who went to a doctor in New Jersey, which is basically suburban New York City, asked for PEP, and his doctor had no idea what PEP was. So this is a real concern. Another potential barrier is the cost. PrEP in the U.S. Will cost at least $8,000 or $9,000 a year, but already we know that a number of private insurers are covering the cost of PrEP, as well as state Medicaid departments. And the approval by the FDA, which occurred in July, and the Public Health Service guidance, which we're expecting soon, will facilitate this kind of coverage. In the global south, low-cost generic medications are available. So for tenofovir emtricitabine, that's available for as low as $108 per person per year. And for just tenofovir, it's $66 a year. That's a lot of money in those countries, but it's not a lot of money here. So global north funders could make this available. And again, targeting the intervention could really increase its cost effectiveness, and it certainly is less expensive than treating somebody with HIV over the lifetime. The Affordable Care Act offers some potential avenues for coverage. It mandates full coverage of a range of preventive services, and it mandates that essential health benefits be covered by insurance traded in the state health insurance exchanges. And essential health benefits include prescription drugs as well as prevention and wellness programs, both of which could be understood to encompass tenofovir emtricitabine for PrEP. So we were hoping for a strong national floor for the essential health benefits. Unfortunately, that's not happening. It's being determined at the state level. But I know, like here in California, San Francisco AIDS Foundation has been very active in ensuring that essential health benefits meet the needs of people with HIV who are already positive. And so we hope that we can see this prevention intervention could also be covered at the state level by the health insurance exchanges. So back in July, we had the FDA approve tenofovir emtricitabine for use as PrEP. That's that crazy acronym there. That's what that refers to. They approved it for use with a number of priority populations that are listed there. The CDC issued interim guidance about a year and a half ago for MSM and just a couple of months ago for heterosexuals. The WHO put out guidance back in the summer as well, and we're hoping to get permanent guidance from the Public Health Service very soon. So the recommendations that we make in the monograph are that states should provide access to PrEP as a critical prevention service under the essential health benefit provision of the Affordable Care Act. Global funders should fund both PrEP and treatment as prevention and should try to strike a balance between funding treatment and biomedical prevention and other forms of prevention. And that the provision of PrEP, particularly in the global south, needs to be in the broader context of clinically competent care for LGBT people. 80 countries outlaw homosexuality, and many of them are in Africa and the Caribbean. And some of the countries hardest hit by HIV, like Guyana and Jamaica, are some of the most countries with some of the strictest anti-gay laws. Those don't help the situation, and they certainly could inhibit clinically competent medical care for gay men and other LGBT people. So it's important that that be addressed as well. One concern that came up in my doing the research was the concern that people who are taking PrEP could become stigmatized because they're the most high risk, right? And so it's important that there be efforts taken to preemptively destigmatize PrEP use. It should be seen as a good thing. It's a public health step. There's a need for public education about the difference between PEP and PrEP, as I mentioned, with both consumers and providers. And people who come in to get PEP could be very good candidates for use of PrEP over the long term. And then community education campaigns are critical, and community involvement should be rolled into that because it's really critical. There's a lot of distrust of the pharmaceutical industry and medicalization of the epidemic and things like that. That's playing out with PrEP, and it's really important that members of the different communities who are most effective, gay men, African Americans, black gay men, heterosexual black women, be included in conversations and planning. But what I want to leave you with is a message of great hope. PrEP has been shown effective with MSM, with heterosexual women and men, and adherence is really key. So if people are adherent, PrEP works, and it's an additional tool in the prevention database. And the regulatory approval that we had in the U.S. this summer allows providers the freedom to prescribe it. They don't need to prescribe it. It's not going to become a panacea, but it's a new, it's an additional tool in our toolkit. And the WHO guidance allows national governments now to kind of step up and decide what they're going to do and to see if they're going to make it available in their country. And the last point about technology, Jim Pickett is a AIDS activist, and he runs a group called the International Rectal Microbicides Advocates, which is advocating on this experimental biomedical intervention. And because a lot of people have raised objections that it's too expensive, it's not going to work, people aren't going to be adherent. And he compares PrEP for HIV prevention today to cell phones 25 years ago. Remember the cell phones? None of you had them. I didn't have them. They were too expensive, right? But wealthy people had these big clunky cell phones in their cars. And now people have smartphones. And so the technology has advanced incredibly, and the cost has come down a lot. And I think that some of the experimental ways of delivering PrEP in a more user-friendly way, like intermittent PrEP, PrEP that you take occasionally, once a week, once a month, injectable PrEP, implants, like we have implantable birth control now, which didn't exist, you know, 30 years ago. If we can figure out those sort of ways to deliver PrEP in ways that could increase adherence and lower cost, that can make PrEP much more accessible to people who could use it. So thank you very much.
Thank you to all of our presenters. We have we'll take questions now if you have any questions for either of the presenters. We have one back here.
and found that there was no significant development of drug resistance in any of those trials beyond what you would see, you know, in general provision of antiretrovirus as treatment. And so it's something that is certainly a concern and has to be monitored. We're not saying, you know, it's a 0% chance of drug resistance development, but there's not a significant concern based on these clinical trials. Now, the real world settings obviously are different from clinical trials. And so there are what are called open label extension trials going on now, where you don't have half of the people in the trial getting the medication, half getting the placebo. You have everybody knowing that they're getting the medication. And so we're looking to see if there's a difference in adherence, difference in behavior, or drug resistance in that real world setting compared to a clinical trial.
And what was the length of those
trials? Well, the IPRETS trial was several years. I think that the two studies that I talked about, Partners PrEP and the Botswana study, were over 2 or 3 years each. So, you know, so at least a few years. And I would encourage you to look at the monograph and then send me an email, and I'd be happy to have a follow-up conversation with you about it. Because it's a very legitimate concern. But all I'm saying is that the research to date doesn't show any elevated risk of drug resistance from taking PrEP or taking emtricitabine and tenofovir for preventive purposes.
So, one other question. When you were developing a sort of financial model of,
right.
Did you calculate into that the adherence piece, which is, if I go to a private doctor and I'm not on PrEP,
right,
and then I lose an insurance or I go to a different doctor, generally that first doctor doesn't follow me. You know, generally that prescribes something you're all in my practice. It's not like
I didn't do the studies. I just summarized the academic literature on cost effectiveness. So it's people like Michelle Lewinsky and other researchers who did this research. So all the studies are cited. I know that, you know, in some of the models, for example, if you have 90% adherence and it's targeted to the most high-risk populations, then it can be cost effective. So those are big ifs. How do you get to, and that's 90% adherence for everybody taking PrEP, not 90% adherence for the, you know, for a subset of the group. It's kind of the big obstacle that has to be overcome is how do we increase adherence rates, you know, to ensure that cost effectiveness can be achieved. You know.
We had one back here.
I would say that we don't know, we don't have sufficient data on several years. But I just was curious in terms of, I think PrEP and the potential, and a lot of stuff in the data. My concern is that it's going to really further biomedicalize the treatment intervention and PrEP.
I think you raised an important point, and it can't be seen as a panacea, but we do have 50,000 new infections a year in the country, like 2.7 million a year globally. In the U.S., 30,000 to 50,000 a month are recommended by infection men, just disproportionately in the So the current approach, primarily focusing on behavioral individual level intervention, is just not working. And so we have to sort of complement that with some additional approaches. And that's my sort of take on PrEP and what it perhaps is.
I totally agree. I just think that the reverse also is purely focusing on transportation.
Right.
We also struggle with that. And all I'm suggesting is that, that happens. But, I completely agree. We don't really have to think in the term we can press it down with the person who can't do it.
Right.
So, but taking a bill is behaviors. So, again, we have to be adherent, and there's an entire culture of taking medication when you're not sick. So, that's another important feature. So, I'm just kind of bringing it up. I'm with you.
We have one.
I think that most PrEP has a human behavioral component to that as well, without
interaction. Okay, we have one last question.
That have been done, it is once a day, oral Truvada, oral tenofovir emtricitabine. There are studies that are looking at intermittent PrEP. So there's a study in France and Quebec that's going on right now. I forget what it's called. Ipergay. Hypergay. But it's IPERGAY. Anyway, so I think it's a study with MSN in France and Quebec. That's looking at intermittent PrEP, which I think could be like pre and post coital PrEP, or like once a week, something like that. So in terms of like the time frame in which you take it, a lot of the concerns, say about the side effects, have to do with long term use of PrEP, and I don't think we should assume that people are necessarily going to be on this for many, many years. They might be on it for a particularly high-risk period in their lives. So it may be that they're on it for 6 months, 2 years, not 10, 20 years. And obviously that would have a cost in the long run.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for attending this session. On behalf of the HIV/AIDS section,